Welcome to Conversations in MedAid, the people behind the research. Hi, Keith. Thank you for joining us today. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Maybe you can just introduce yourself to listeners. Who are you? Where are you based? What are you doing?
So I'm Raif El-Fakhri. I'm a dentist by education. I transitioned to medical education sector. I became a researcher and kind of more of an advocate. Now I'm the executive director of AIMS, which is the Association for Medical Education in Syria. Now, most of my work focuses on developing medical education in Syria in resource-limited settings, and I inspire a lot of my work from various global research. If I would like to say, how did I first come into medical education? It's a bit of a long story, to be honest, but I'll try to make it brief. So I'm currently visiting in Syria. I'm supervising a project, the establishment of my organization, but most probably I'll be going back to the UK afterwards, or maybe the Gulf, because I have work there. So my story with medical education is, when I was in my undergrads and studying dentistry, of course, dentistry is not a, you know, cheap kind of education. Although the education is free, the materials, treating patients is all on your own financial account. So it can be expensive. So I started teaching English as a second language as a teacher. I tried to several institutes. I failed first year, then the second year, you know, it worked. I became an English language teacher. In my third year at dental school, I was working part-time. I got a lot of courses and I got really into education. The thing is, the institute that I was working on, he didn't just allow anybody to teach. So he gave me a book, The Practice of English Language Teaching. It was by Jeremy Harmer. So it has a lot of the sciences of teaching and learning, and so a lot of these things that I almost read all of it. And I got really inspired by how structured the teaching process need to be. It's not, you know, as I first experienced in Syria, and what makes some teachers great, what makes others not so, and how can learning be facilitated and so on. So I got really enthusiastic about it, really passionate about it, and I got into it like really hard, and I, you know, done really well as an English language teacher. My students used to like me and stuff. Then in my fourth year as a dental student, I wanted it. It was a pretty devastating year for me. So because like it was just one subject, and because I missed the date of that, you know, module, so I didn't take the exam. It was a very stupid mistake. They moved the date, but I didn't know that they moved the date. So it was an honest mistake. So in that year, I didn't have much to do. So I was left with a part-time job and a lot of time, free time that I did not know where to go with. So I was thinking of doing some research, and I was drawing some drafts thinking of what subject will I research, what am I interested in. So the first thing I got is to see, so I observed a phenomenon, which is a lot of the Arabic countries, all of the Arabic countries teach medicine in English, except for Syria, which teaches, of course, other Arabic countries do have some modules in Arabic, but medicine in general, English is the language of instruction in dental and health professional schools. But in Syria, it's not. Arabic is the language. Of course, that's because of the Al-Ba'ath party agenda. And, you know, it's one of their, you know, their tools to control the country. One of their selling messages to preserve the Arabic identity of Syria. So I started to research whether English or Arabic which whether English or Arabic should be the language of instruction currently. And the topic was more complicated than I first thought. It wasn't as a matter of preference. It was like, you can't just move students and make them learn in another language that easily. It's a much difficult process. So I started reading research, reading opposite opinions, reading why they started teaching in English. I got the hegemony of other countries that try to enforce their cultures on Arabic countries. So that's why they pursued English. I got, some Arabic countries seeing, the global north as, the leader or authority. So that's why they teach in Arabic. I studied some financial reasons for it because they don't have a lot of resources to translate all this material in English into Arabic immediately. So they just transitioned into English. So it was a very multifaceted phenomenon. So I did the research, participated in a national scientific research competition at the school, and I won first place. And, from there on, it sparked, this is the first spark in medical education. And actually, one of the most people that I really still inspire me to this day is my professor, Issam Jamous, who really helped me and, guided me through the scientific research process. He studied prosthodontics at Newcastle University. He got a PhD there, and he was really educated in terms of scientific research, but it's more of a scientific natural sciences research, it's not much of a social sciences research aspect. But I learned a lot of it. I learned a lot from him, and I learned as much as possible. He was truly, helpful, although, there's nothing much to have in helping a student doing independent research for the university. Our research is not funded usually, it's student-led, and they usually focus on getting credit to get to publish research, and so that when they travel, they can, for example, get better opportunities, get a better edge. And after graduation, I decided that I want to go into medical education. I thought my mission in life, there are a lot of dentists in this world. There are a lot of great dentists. And I honestly, knowing myself, I thought I can't compete with this, with these good dentists. But I could become a decent dentist. But I think my call in life would be medical education. I think this country really needs some minds who can, draw a roadmap for this country to a better future, because this is not how medical education should be. I suffered a lot as a dental student, because I knew how real education need to be. I saw that the wide discrepancy between how students are taught and how the ideal situation is. So there were a lot of, treating students as a workforce rather than, trying to teach them while they learn. Patients sometimes get in the harm's way because of there is not enough supervision, assessment not being very honest, fair, or really well designed. So these things really made me boil inside. This feeling that someone needs to do something about this. But the thing is, nobody can see it. That's the situation. Nobody can see that, what's wrong with this and what the alternative needs to be. So I got myself into this and said, okay, nobody's going to do it. I'm going to put myself in this road and try to do as much as good as I can, as best as I can. And I did a lot of research. I did research on learning environment. I did research on self-assessment because a lot of the supervisors and teachers were just not interested in teaching. Of course, there are exceptions. But because they are not very well paid, they are not very well compensated, and they're not well taught in teaching. Most of the distinguished students usually come from those self-driven students to make themselves better. And students amongst themselves, second-year students usually get help from fourth-year students, and so on. So it's more of a collaborative process rather than there's a teacher and he's there to help me. So the teacher was not usually there, and he's usually away at his own hospital or clinic. So I started focusing on self-assessment and peer assessment, trying to make students maximize the use of these learning approaches so that they can maximize their benefits of learning themselves, because you know there's no other way here. So you need to figure out how to improve yourself on your own, while at the same time try to get as much help as possible from peers, from teachers if available, try to make do, let's say, with what available resources you've got. And I published multiple papers on it. I was, you know, every time, because Syria is very isolated in nature, it's, you know, we have sanctions and everything. So there wasn't much communication with the, you know, outside world. But in research, I found a way to connect with other experts who could really, you know, inform my research. And the review process, I didn't take it as a challenge or as a bureaucratic obstacle to get my research published. I saw it as an opportunity to learn. Yeah. Each time a researcher or a reviewer points out a certain gap in my research, I usually, okay, I'll acknowledge this. I will not try to cover it up. I'll acknowledge this. I'll see, I'll say what I did to avoid this. But next time in my next edition research, I'll try to avoid this. And I truly started learning. Publication or doing research became more of a learning process. Each time I'm facing new reviewers, new challenges, learning more things. This reviewer pointing me to this reference, this reviewer pointing me to that reference. I'm reading this, I'm reading that. So I realized at a certain point, yeah, I think I'm learning from this process. So I took advantage of this, and I took, you know, advantage of my passion in this, you know, for medical education. And I have applied for Achievement Scholarship. It's a 1 year, you know, offered by the UK government, FCDO, to study a 1 year master's in the UK. So, and I knew that they are looking for people like me who has like passion for a certain cause, passion to develop their country, a passion to fix something in their country. Mm-hmm. So I've applied for it. It wasn't an easy thing. It's like I tried three times, 3 years. So first time I wasn't shortlisted. Second time I was shortlisted and was put on the waiting list. Third time I was shortlisted and chosen. Wow. And that was, you know, but each time, you know, I'm learning, even though, you know, the last time I got two different scholarships, one in Germany and the other one is in the UK. So the one in Germany was 2 years and in Munich University. So, and the other one was in Oxford University. So they were both great universities, but I made the hard choice and chose, you know, research and medical education is much more developed in the UK than it is in Germany. Yeah. So I chose, you know, the UK as a destination because I wanted to mingle with those enthusiasts in medical education. And I really found, you know, a lot of people, yeah, just like yourself.
Yeah, that's what we meant. No, thank you so much for sharing. It's really interesting to me to see how, well, besides your personal resilience and your persistence and commitment, and, you know, applying again until you're successful. I think that's one big takeaway. I think the other is that your sort of growth mindset, so being open to learning. I think often when it comes to publishing and peer review, it can be quite daunting and uncomfortable, and yet you've really embraced it and see it as sort of an iterative process and a learning process. I think that's another great takeaway. Also your advocacy based on your personal experiences. You know, I think it can be very easy to become sort of burnt out or disillusioned, and you've sort of gone in the other direction with this passion and this desire to improve things in your home country. And I just wanted to flag that all the sort of research that Heath has mentioned has been published, and I do want to get you to look at those publications. And just building on that, you've obviously described a very challenging context in Syria, and you mentioned AIMS, so the Association for Medical Education in Syria. What is that organization? Why have you started it? What are you hoping that it achieves?
So thank you for your question. This is a very good question. I wanted to touch on that. So in Syria, there is no culture of medical education. There is no culture that our teaching needs to be grounded with some kind of rule or people, experts in this. Our own mentality, it's an old-fashioned mentality, which is, you know, we get the best person in this field. For example, we get the best person in cardiothoracic surgery, and we get him to be the dean of the school or the, you know, head of the school, and he'll run things very well. We'll expect him to run things very well because he's very well, very good in his field. But turns out this does not apply. This does not work. Him being a brilliant cardiothoracic surgeon does not translate into him being a great teacher, or like being able to transfer this knowledge and experience and skills to other people. This does not work at all. Some people, they don't know the basic, the principles, and the way a dental school or a medical school should be run or should be grounded with the curriculum, the assessment, the learning environment, the policies, even the policies at a very basic level. So the learning policies are actually working against the student and the patients at the same time. So the student finds himself in, like, what should I do? If I need to pass the exam, I need to do like something not very related to what I'm actually going to practice. And this was really frustrating for so many people. So I decided there needs to be something done about this. And it needs to come from a person who does not have any, let's say, profit, let's say, wants to just improve this, you know, sector or raise this culture, not for personal gain or not for anything like this. So I started AIMS, which is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization. Of course, we're hoping to work with the Ministry of Higher Education, other universities, medical schools, dental schools, pharmacy schools. But, you know, being independent, being non-governmental, being non-profit helps us say what we believe, criticize openly, not being bound by certain policies or certain people that do not allow us to say what needs to be said in certain kind of contexts. So I decided, you know, this needs to be an independent organization. We might not have the ability to implement changes in ourselves, but we can definitely stir these schools and the community and the medical education sector in a certain way, and build a culture of awareness, build a culture of advocacy that this field needs to be run by specialized people who know what to do, who know how medical students need to be taught, or at least trying to do their best to learn. You can't just leave it in the hands of people who are great in their field. That's amazing. They could, with certain training, do teach, but you cannot have a medical school run by just a surgeon. This does not work. He needs to be educated on so many levels: policy level, education strategies, assessment strategies, so many things. And it need to be non-political. Non-political, as this is not a place where you show prestige to yourself as the dean of the school or the chancellor of the university. This is a place where it needs to come from the heart, that this society needs someone to push the wheel further for development. And this is what we were lacking in the assets regime. That's, you know, everyone's appointed then for political reasons and so on. You know, there are, of course, there are some exceptions, but usually Al-Ba'ath Party usually has the appointment in their hands, and they usually appoint people who are affiliated with the government that usually implements policies or decisions just for their own, you know, or to support their own agenda, not for, you know, the benefit of the school or something. This can be very dystopian, but unfortunately, it's the truth. I don't mean to adopt a negative, pessimistic outlook, by the way.
No, you're coming across very hopeful and positive and passionate, I think, despite the challenges. And what is your vision sort of for the future of medical education in Syria? Like, what do you want to achieve, and how do you think you can get there?
What I honestly would like the medical schools or the medical education sector in Syria to avoid now, it's coming out of Assad's regime, out of dictatorship. I just don't want them to go blind and adopt a certain curriculum in a global north school. I think this could be a big mistake, and it's easy to fall for. It's easy to see, like, so many schools adopting very, you know, Western global north curriculums and policies. But the thing is, we need to come from, as you once told me, we need to come from the principles. Mm. We need to have certain values. We need to understand the community need. We need to understand our students. Who are our students? Who are our community? Who are our patients? What's this school is built for? What's the ultimate objective? It's not just teaching students to be good doctors. It's teaching students to be, to help patients. Mm. You know, being a good doctor does not always translate into great care. You know, you need to foster this drive in students to help their communities. Mm. And be committed to, let's say, a better healthcare, conscious self, morally conscious self healthcare. So, and from that, we can build things from the ground up, and maybe even from the top down, adopting things where we see it fits. But I think it should be built meticulously, and it's going to take some time, but. I think this is the right way to go, instead of just, you know, having a plan ready. Okay, let's go for it.
I agree. You've said a lot of valuable things today. Maybe just one or two sort of take-home messages or lessons that you've learned, or maybe advice to others, whether they're researchers or educators or, you know, the healthcare workers you're wanting to reach. Any sort of take-home messages for them?
Okay, now being a medical education expert, researcher, consultant, or in this field, maybe it doesn't have, you know, it does not bring the same monetary value as being a doctor, a dentist, or, you know, being in the health profession. It's not a business. Neither medicine is a business, neither is medical education. But it's really rewarding. It's going to be very, very rewarding when you see that, you know, this student, these students that you've taught became doctors, and now they're helping hundreds and thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of patients. And you had a part, you had a contribution in this. You would not be wealthy. You're not gonna be wealthy, but you're gonna be, you know, morally satisfied. You're gonna be happy with what you achieved. And at this time, Syria needs these medical education experts more than ever. Mm. So if you're in Syria, if you're Syrian or somewhere, you can help yourself or maybe become a medical education expert yourself. I'd definitely recommend this pathway if you are passionate about it.
And on that note, I'll leave it. I agree. Heath has sort of issued the call. So get in touch with him. I'll have his contact details in the show notes. I'll have a link to his publications and to AIMS. So I wish you all the best in transforming medical education in Syria. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, two-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics, theory, and evidence from the field, and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage. Links can be found in the show notes.